accession number 23089, reel 3.
Margaret Cornish Rideout, and this is reel 3. Yes, you were saying about the toll system.
Yes.
Now, did this relate to pay?
No. It did for the boat people, of course, because they were paid by the cargoes, the tonnage of the cargoes they carried. We were paid as by the Ministry of Transport a flat rate, a flat wage of £2 a week while we were training, £3 a week when we were fully trained and were working as crew on boats. That meant if you took time off, which occasionally we did when it was possible, at the end of a trip maybe, and there were no cargoes waiting to be collected, and we'd take a few days off to go back to our homes, we were not paid for those days. We were only paid as long as we were working. But the scheme worked, I think, because most of us who came onto the scheme came for the kind of lifestyle that it offered and really were not very financially conscious of the financial rewards. It was a way of life, and you either liked it or you loathed it. And most people who came soon found that they loathed it. Not only was it the actual work itself very hard, you had to be strong, athletic, and pretty agile as well. You had to jump down from lock sides onto a cabin top and to miss into a narrow space between the water jug, the windlass, and the coils of rope. So you had about 6 square inches on which to land, and you had to be precise about it. You also, there were times when you had to heave yourself up from the top of the cabin onto a lock side. Perhaps the boats had got jammed or something was wrong with, they hadn't been tied properly, and you had to do something about it. So you had to be agile and strong. Apart from that, the living conditions were extremely basic, as I've already mentioned. Very small cabins. If only we'd had a few of the present-day mod cons, such as a nice, comfortable sleeping bag, for instance. There was no nylon. People realised there was no nylon in those days, so we had nothing but, well, my dipper, which is underneath that little table there, which was a multi-purpose thing. You washed up, washed yourself, washed your hair, washed your clothes in it. Water, of course, was extremely scarce. There were certain water taps en route, and you had to know where they were. We had 2 large cans. They were painted red. When you've been on a little while, you've got a properly painted can with roses and all the traditional embellishments, which were done by Nurser from Braunston at Nurser's Yard, and he would only do them for those who actually worked on the boats. So they have become quite precious. I still have my dipper and my stool that he did. I did have a water can, and I think I bequeathed it to somebody else when I left the Alphonse. And there was, of course, no toilet. The only form of toilet was a bucket in the engine room, a tin bucket. Very uncomfortable. We were very conscious of flanges on the buckets and the way... And in a very restricted area, and in the cold weather when we had lots of clothes as such, it was very pretty dicey, because you had a great big flywheel buzzing around. And it was dangerous, yes, you had to be very careful. So I think anybody who had weak bowels or bladder, they soon left. They couldn't cope. I understand it perfectly well. And I suppose I had lived at a pretty basic level in my first teaching post when I was in this country school. It was a privy across the paddock with a gander that used to stand guard outside. And he learned when I had a stick available. So I was used to it, but I really, and of course sailing on the return, that was the name of the boat on the Broads, again we had no lavatory on board. It was get into the hedges if you could ever get a landing, and when wind was going you didn't stop. So you learned to control. So that, and when I think back, you see that all the women particularly, we couldn't get sanitary towels, no deodorants. You're lucky if you could get soap. So that the actual living conditions would have deterred a great number. Even after a week of such living, they used to disappear into the night. I can remember, I'll just sidetrack a little bit. We had two on board, and it was during the very bad ice up stage. That would have been 40, was a very bad winter with the ice up. We were iced up near Leamington, and we had two poor girls on board. Well, they did nothing but moan about the food, the conditions, the cold. And I wrote in my diary, it's not surprising, because it was, the conditions were very, very grim. And we tied up at the Blue Lias, as we couldn't go any further. The boats were held by the ice. Even held, I mean, you still had to free them every day. You had to go round with the shaft pole, this long pole with a spike at the end of it, to break the ice round to keep the boats afloat. You couldn't afford to let the ice close right in on them. And the poles, we used to call them shafts. They were conch poles on the Broads, but they were shafts on the canals. We used to call them poles in aspic, because they were totally coated in ice. And you couldn't wear gloves, because they just got wet and frozen. So you had to go around with this pole in aspic, breaking the ice all round. Anyway, we kept the fires alight as best we could, but we weren't carrying the right kind of coal for burning. We were carrying nutty slack, which was no good. It just provided smoke and nothing else. Very little heat. Anyway, we knew that they were terribly... And Daphne had said, well, look, there's a station down the road, you know, if you like, we'll help you off. No, they wouldn't. But we heard them go early one morning, and they had to clamber across the butty boat, as I say, would be tied nearest the towpath. And they disappeared, and... Daphne said, if only, you know, they'd been a little bit more friendly, we willingly have helped them. But of course, I suppose they felt guilty and just leaving us in the lurch, because that meant we had to go two-handed, which we did very well. I used to love going two-handed. We're much more efficient going two-handed without having to watch what other people were doing all the time and making a mess of it. So those were the conditions, apart from the work, the living conditions and the food. You see, we were always, I can remember, always being hungry, because we had no extra rations, and even the emergency ration cards that we had could not always be implemented, because the small shops, which were close to the canal side, only had enough rations for their regular customers. So that very often we couldn't even get what we were entitled to. I remember living. Luckily the bread was still available. And an extraordinary thing was that when we got to Birmingham, we used to make for Littlewoods. Now, you would think that sort of peanut butter would have been a produce of something imported, but we could always get peanut butter. Peanut butter, slabs of bread and peanut butter, and cocoa, again another import that you could always get. So we used to have cocoa, made with evaporated milk. Now, we could buy evaporated milk. There was always a store at a place called Fenny Stratford, where there was another toll office where we were gauged. The cargo was gauged. And we used to buy as much as we could afford, tins and tins of evaporated milk. And I can remember a sort of living on slabs of peanut bread, peanut butter, and cocoa made with evaporated milk. and tins of bully beef, corned beef. And I used to seem to be the cook always. It used to make these awful stews with, put everything in, any potatoes. Of course, if we could find a few potatoes lying on the towpath, well, we had no conscience about it, we picked up anything we could find. Sometimes we were lucky to get a few vegetables in season, of course, from locksides. Lockkeepers' wives would be quite good to us. Later on, when I had my own boats, Hercules and the it was Hyperion afterwards. I had Hercules first, order of driver, but Hyperion and Cetus, and we were hired out to S.E. Barlow to do the run on the Oxford Canal. And at Somerton, I always remember, there was a very kindly farmer's wife, and she used to say, "Let me know when you're coming by, and I'll have a dinner ready for you." And she would have a chicken already trussed and prepared for the oven, and all the vegetables round. And we used to defy all the rules and tie up in order that that wonderful dinner would not be burnt, because these little ranges were devils. They either burned fiercely and burnt everything, or they went dead on you. So you had to cosset them along. Oh, goodness me. But that was a treat, a very seldom experienced. But that was only later on when we were doing on the Oxford run. On the Grand Union, where I spent the first part with 6 months with Daphne, it was quite hard going, because the people who came, and they were a mixture. I remember one woman, she'd been a secretary, she lived in a bedsit in London. I mean, heated bedsit, you know, central heating and all the rest. Hadn't got a clue. She didn't have any sort of clothes that were suitable. Again, we were always, I took my best walking shoes, which I thought were pretty tough to go on, and they were absolutely inadequate. You needed men's boots to cope with the rough cinder paths, certainly down round the back of the lower road around Birmingham. They were awful cinder tracks. And you needed strong boots to dig in to the ground in order to move the heavy gates. So, you know, inadequate clothing, not enough food, and then perhaps having to share a minute cabin with somebody you hated the sight of first, though. So it was no wonder that they didn't stay. It was a wonder that anybody stayed.
How were you getting on during your first trip that, you know, you have described for us, so the picking up of the load and the sheeting up, and that you didn't have to do, but you described the process. How were you getting on with Bash and Mary?
Well, they were again two of the kind I've just described, who were totally unsuited to be sharing a cabin. Mary was very, very she was very sensitive and very tolerant of Bash. Bash was, there was a move in the ministry to recruit EastEnders who thought very misguidedly that they would be tough and be able to stick it better than the so-called middle class sort of trainees. Well, Bash was one of the EastEnders, but she complained more than anybody. And I think she wanted to stay. And I can remember going up, we went quite a distance. She would go to the pub in the evening, but she rather used to sort of go drink too much and come back. And I remember she came back once with a with a young man she'd found and brought him back to the boats, and we were asleep in bed, Daphne and I. We weren't asleep, obviously. But, of course, to cross over to her, the motorboat, she would have to pass over. We weren't singled out. We were tied, what we call breasted up, that next to each other. And we heard her being sick, and Daphne said, "Oh, not on the boats, please." But the next morning, I don't know, I can't remember, and I know the young man didn't come on board. And next morning, she had a very bad hangover and said she couldn't eat anything. But I remember she did manage to swallow quite a big dose. I seem to have porridge. I made some porridge, and she managed to eat that. She was strong, but she wasn't athletic, and she was cumbersome. And, you know, I know I felt, she didn't, I was a mutual disregard for each other, I think. I think she lasted half a trip, no more. Mary, unfortunately, was very sad. I think she'd had a history of mental illness, and her mother had put her, or she was in some kind of an institution and had come away from it. She was a delightful girl, but much too delicate and sensitive. She might have made it on the boats, I don't know. But anyway, we were told, Daphne had a message that Miss Min would be meeting us back at the depot when we returned. And she took Wendy away, oh gosh, that was her real name, I've given her real name, Mary, away with her. And we never saw what happened. Bash, her name was Peggy. I did call her Peggy, trying to make amends, you know, and trying to make some sort of contact with her. But I think she liked me a bit better after that. I think she did stay. Did she stay the whole trip? Disappeared at Tisley. She may have done a whole trip. I can't really remember. But there was no more than just the one trip. And then we had this secretary who'd only lived in a centrally heated bedsit and totally inadequate clothing and so on. And who was with her? Oh, there was Elsie, who was a little dressmaker person. Now, she was extraordinary. And she was determined to stick it at all costs. And stick it she did in her Wellington boots, and she had a brown tweed coat, a zigzag, what you call it, herringbone tweed coat. I can see her now at the tiller, at always, and she's had, I think, that disease that disfigures your face, lupus, is it? And glasses. But small, diminutive, and tough. And she stuck it for some time. And she was on with this other person, we'll call her Audrey. Well, I can remember another incident. We were going with those particular two up through Watford, Casey Park, as Cassiabury Park, but we call it Casey Park. And there's a nice little lock there, a very pleasant lock, and a water tap. And these two were newcomers, and you really had to watch every single move because of the boats. They could get the fenders, that's the, fenders at the back and front of the boats, they could catch under the gates, and you had to move the boats accordingly up and down the locks so they wouldn't catch. On, that's an uphill lock, and going downhill on the sill. And I think I was busy with a water jug. I know I was busy with the water jug, looked round, and to my horror, saw that the butty boat, the fender on the back of the butty boat, had caught under one of the crossbeams of the lock gates and was not rising with the rise of water, so the water was pouring in. Well, we shouted, of course, and unwound the paddles as quick as ever we could to stop the inflow of water. And luckily, when we were going through a lock, the big heavy tiller from the butty was always taken out of its slot and put on the cabin top. Otherwise it would swing, of course, and catch. And for some reason, the person who had taken it out of its slot, instead of putting it on the cabin top, had stood it in the hatchway, and that had made the doors close of the cabin, so actually the water had only just begun to seep into the cabin. So we see, it was a nasty experience, because you could easily sink the boats in a lock like that, very easily done. That night we tied up and had a very wet night. I remember recording a very wet, trying to dry out everything in the butty cabin. Staggered up the towpath, there was certain places where we could have, we were offered baths, and we had a list of places we could have. I went up the towpath, a muddy towpath, to Dudswell. That's near Tring, near the summit. But no luck. There was no hot water, so no bath, so I had to come back. And that was the difficulty, you see, in those days, in war times. Very, quite a few good people, I've got a list, I think, of those who offered us baths, and you get there, but no hot water, or offers what facilities there are. And very often, and then again, we were so dirty a lot of the time, we didn't like going into somebody's nice clean bathroom and leaving muddy footprints everywhere and so on, and we didn't use them. The only real time we used baths was were the public baths at Tyseley. And there again, you were only given a certain allocation of hot water, and then it shooted into the bath, and you very carefully added your cold water so that you didn't waste any of the hot. And I can remember I used to wash my hair, wash my clothes, and then wash myself in all the same water. So these basic living conditions did make for problems apart from the actual work itself. As I said, the work was fraught with possible dangers. It could easily happen. You could, in the ice up, when all the guardrails on the locks, you stuck to them. And of course, freeing the locks of blocks of ice before you could even use the locks. We went as long as we could, and as I said, we were iced up at near Lymington. The word's gone. And I remember that we, Daphne and I, were left solo on the boats. We were marooned there. There was a pub nearby, and very reluctantly they let us use their pump to get water. And because of the kindness of Amy, I remember her name, that came back, who was the person in charge, what do you call her? Anyway, we had to go and drink in their very cold sort of bar room, their very cold ale. Neither of us liked it. But we used to, in the daytime, walk into Lymington and go to the pump room and have tea there in the pump room. And there was a trio called Van der Ven's Trio, and they used to play all our requests. So it was a height of luxury and much appreciated. So that was the ice up for us. Eventually, of course, the icebreaker came and freed us, and we were able to get down to Braunston. But again, we were holed up, and we were unfortunate. We had the wrong kind of coal on board. It was coal, I suppose, for one of the paper mills, because coal was our most important cargo, actually, to supply all the canal side factories such as Heinz and ABC and the paper mills of Croxley and Langley, and down the Oxford, the Osburton Radiators and the Wolvercote paper mills.
Would that have been a return load?
Yes, it was always a return. It came to the point when there were very few, the coasters weren't coming into Limehouse or Brentford towards the end, and we were having to go back empty boats back up to the coalfields, which was a sign that the end was coming, really, because it was... But the factories, you see, in those days depended on coal for energy. Electricity and nuclear and all the rest of it. And, I mean, it was coal.
Was that a very dirty load?
Oh, it was filthy. It was awful. I mean, coaling up was always... shut down everything. Kept the hatches firmly closed, but the grit got in everywhere. You always could... I can taste it now. And, yes, it couldn't be helped. And it depended on what coal you were carrying. Sometimes there were DS nuts, I remember, and then Nutty Sack was awful. We always hoped we would carry reasonable domestic coal so that we could use them on our stoves, you see, because we depended totally on the coal for heating and cooking. But I think that time we were carrying it. Longford was a good place for coaling up. That was near Hawkesbury. And it was plummeted down, of course, with big chutes from the side. We were being coaled up when peace was declared, the first peace. VE Day, which was the first one?
VE Day, yes.
And we were, it came over the loudspeaker that had been declared, and we were all agog. But the man who was Mr. Flowers, who was coaling us, all he was interested in was getting his boats coaled up. And we had to shift a ton. They'd overloaded the motor because at that time we were going down the Oxford, which was shallow. And they'd put too much on the motor. And we had to we all had these big spades, you know, what do you call them? Spades.
The shovels.
Shovels, that's right. We had to shovel a ton of it off onto the butty. Oh, yes, you had to level the loads. You had to level them by hand with your shovels. We always carry shovels, of course. Because, as I say, the freeboard was only a few inches, so you had to trim the boats to make sure that they were, you know, level. That time when I'm going back to the ice up now, we didn't have the proper coal. We had only Nutty Slack or something dreadful that didn't burn. And so we were cold. I can remember waking up and the walls of the cat were covered in ice inside. Oh, yes.
How long would you have been iced up that time?
Sorry?
How long would you have been? Would it have been as much as a week?
Oh, yes, quite a week. Because we went scouting for wood, anything that we could burn. And we did find a pile of coal was it Itchings and Locks there? I can't remember. Down below Locks, sort of well hidden back. Now, you see, very often the boat people themselves, coal was a good bartering commodity. And very often the boat people themselves, if they knew somebody was following or they wanted, anyway, they would leave a pile of, if they had good household coal, they would leave a pile by a lock so nobody would ever touch it because you knew it was left for some person, somebody or other. Anyway, we found this pile of coal. Well, we were desperate. So we filled our buckets, and we filled both coal boxes in both boats, butty and the motor. And then, oh dear, we were found out. The irate lock keeper for whom this coal was designated came and accused us of stealing his coal. And he made us put it back. And, you know, after all, lock keepers were the law. They really ruled the roost in those days. You depended on them for their help, their goodwill and everything else. And they could be a friend, or they could be very difficult. So we didn't